the materials that the transistor is made out of start becoming a dummy load. So that's a factor. The radiation from your, the undesired radiation from your particular layout of the circuit means that some of the energy that you've applied doesn't get to the output connector. It gets sprayed other places around your circuit. So there's lots and lots of mechanisms. Your bypass capacitors are not as good as you go to higher frequencies. Your inductors are not as good as you go to higher frequencies. So you get more loss from your L's, from your C's, from your R's, from the silicon, from transit time loading, and whatever. So lots and lots of things are fighting you. Which ones are dominant at each frequency, you could worry about that. But there's a zillion kinds of loss mechanisms, as you can tell, Joe. Maybe that helps a little bit. WHYYY, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, great. Good answer. Thanks. I'll be listening. WHYYY.
Okay. Now, of the people who signed in at the beginning of the TechNet, I think I've gone down that whole list. Bob was the last one, OSR, but he said he had to leave us, and we promised that during the first hour we'll go over to the mailbag so that the younger people who are getting their ham license get a chance to get their questions answered before they have to go to sleep and go to school tomorrow. And then after we go to the mailbag, we'll pick up those other people who signed in late. So, Mel? What's the burning questions in your mailbag this week? K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Just opened it up, and we are starting to look right now because I only have two hands, and I'm trying to do three things. How do you like that? Okay, but all right, we'll get to the mailbag right now. Let me go real quick, just pick out some. Okay, here comes a quickie that we can get onto, and then I'll look for some more. When it comes to HF antennas, how important is elevation angle? You want to answer that, Dick? I'll give them some other factors about that that are very interesting and that has come up in the last year, some very good info on that. But first, how important is elevation angle? Go ahead.
Yeah, Mel is more of an HF operator than I am. I'm more of a VHF, UH operator. I'm going to give you my answer, and then Mel's going to give you his answer on this one. When you set your dipole, your ground plane, any of your HF antennas, your loops, your cubicle quad, your beverage, your rhombic, whatever kind of an HF antenna you're using, your biggest decision is, do I have enough property? Do I have enough high trees to mount it on or a telephone pole? Is my building tall enough? Is the chimney of my house tall enough? When you select the altitude off the ground for the antenna, you may not know it, but you're really, in many cases, setting the elevation angle. By that I mean the antenna itself, you'd like it to be nice and high up in order to give a good, clean signal out to the horizon. Most of the people you want to talk to are out there on the horizon. Let me drop. And except for satellite work, very few of those people are straight overhead to you. You look at that dirt in your backyard and you think it's ground. That radio signal looks at that dirt and it sees it almost as a mirror. As such, you've got a real antenna above ground. You've got a mirror image of your antenna below ground by way of the ground reflection. And as such, for a horizontally polarized antenna, that ground gives you 180 degrees of phase shift. So you've got a real antenna above ground. You've got a mirror image antenna that's out of phase below ground. It's there automatically, whether you do it, whether you want it to be there or not. The difference between those two antennas in wavelengths determines at what elevation angle is the stronger signal. As you make the antenna higher and higher above the ground, there's more and more wavelengths of spacing between the image antenna and the real antenna, and therefore that main first lobe gets lower and lower to the ground. That's where you'd like it to be most of the time. Once you know how far away in miles or thousands of miles is the guy you want to talk to, whether it be London or Japan or Australia, and once you know the state of the ionosphere, in most cases, there is an ideal takeoff angle that'll hit the ionosphere at the right angle so you get the best number of bounces between you and the guy you want to talk to. So if this is the best of all worlds, you're going to have multiple antennas at different altitudes or a way of raising and lower the antenna altitude, so you can get the right takeoff angle in elevation so that you hit the ionosphere the right way and give you the strongest signal to the guy you want to talk to. Very few of us do all that, but it's nice to know. So as you choose the altitude of your antenna, for the most part, you're choosing the elevation angle. You'd like to believe that if you go from design A to design B of antenna, that that's going to control the elevation angle. For the most part, that's usually not true, because the dominant factor...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Don't forget to tell them that the frequency has a lot to do with that, too. When you go up in frequency, that becomes almost irrelevant.
Yeah, that's a good point there, Barry's telling us. The takeoff angle is not only elevation in feet, but it's elevation in wavelengths. So as you go to higher and higher bands, the same number of feet off the ground, like 30 feet off the ground, is a larger number of wavelengths. Therefore, the elevation angle of the first lobe gets lower and lower. Go to a high enough frequency, this factor becomes a secondary or tertiary. So number of wavelengths above the ground tells you elevation angle. And most of the time, if you're a real DX hound, you'd like that elevation angle to be as low as possible. I'll bet you've had multiple altitude antennas, and you've discovered that there's an ideal altitude of antenna for the particular guy you want to talk to most of the time. I wonder if that's true, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, this is HF. That's what he's asking. The question was, when it comes to HF antennas, how important is elevation angle? All right. Now, as Dick said, it's quite important because it determines how many hops you may hear the station, and your friend that has an antenna, a different antenna system, may hear it, that same station much stronger. And he seems like he easily works them, and you seem like you're struggling or don't get much of a signal report, if any. The ARRL did publish in the handbook a chart that shows the optimum elevation angles for most of the locations, general locations in the United States. And I'll say a few words about that. One second, let me let it drop. Okay. And it shows for most of the DXing on from 10 meters to 75 meters, where most of the HF DXing takes place, that a takeoff angle somewhere between 5 and 15 degrees is optimum. So you definitely don't want to look for, you know, have an antenna that has a 90 degree that would be straight up. That would not be a good angle for long distance communication. So if you can find some way of going between around 5 and 15 degrees, you're usually going to be in a ballpark. So when it comes to low angles that are most effective, that is what seems to be the most effective. This means that the horizontal antennas, unfortunately, have to be high. Seems like higher is usually better. This is what I found. Let me say a couple of words about height. Okay, so if we use my location as an example, I'm right here at the ocean. So I'm at sea level, basically. And I have a tower in the backyard here that's 85 feet tall, and it seems to work extremely well. However, whether or not a little bit more, would I really 100 feet, I don't know. But the suggestion is here, if you read the article, like I say, if you go to the handbook, you'll read the article, you'll see that that's what they suggest. They get this so-called 5 to 15 degrees in most of the United States, approximately 100 feet above ground, take care of most of amateur radio problems on HF or DXing. Dick, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to add something to this one, Mel. If you don't have a tall enough tree, a tall enough tower, a tall enough chimney of the house and whatever to get the antenna 100 feet above the ground, which would be very ideal on most of the HF frequencies, don't let that stop you. Because your system is not ideal, don't lose a whole lot of sleep about it. if you are able to only get the antenna 20 feet off the ground, and you're not going to be able to be a big noise to get break that pile up of that DX station you'd like to talk to, don't let that stop you. Still going to be getting on the air, talking to people, getting answers, and having some fun. And later on, when you get a chance, you're going to put up a second or a third or a fourth antenna. Maybe it's wire, maybe it's going to be more elaborate, and you're going to be setting it in different directions at different altitudes. So even if you don't have enough altitude to make you as happy as you'd like to be, don't let that stop you. Put it up anyhow. There are guys, that, the worst example I know of, which was a popular antenna in jokes, so to speak. Let me drop it. 20 years ago, there was a guy who was a member of this club named Herbie. I can't remember Herbie's call letters. And his landlord would not let him put any kind of an antenna on the house, in the trees, whatever. His landlord would never let him do anything. He created the Herbie Snake antenna by putting various pieces of coaxial cable together and hooking them just right and laying them flat on the lawn. He was a 20-meter operator on 14 megacycles. He was not a real DX hound, but he made CUSOs with the antenna flat on the lawn itself. And the landlord couldn't tell him to not do that because the landlord didn't see it as an antenna, if you know what I mean. So the Herbie Snake antenna, not a great design to write home about, but that's the worst condition I can think of. And he got out and he made contacts and he was having some fun, particularly having fun telling people what he's using as an antenna and the fact that it was working. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, what's the next question? K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, of course. I never discourage anybody. I says, listen, don't look at the tower and all. Get on the air. Yeah, well, you'll make contact. I'm sure you'll work the station. Maybe. Another story, but in fact, you want to know something, Dick? Many times, just for fun, I use a little QRP rig I have. And let me see what I can do with a QRP rig rather. Sure, no problem most of the time. In fact, I can honestly say I've never had a problem working a DX station in any pileups, eventually working them with, of course, the antenna system and the kilowatt amplifier. But occasionally I have worked, and I've done this a number of times, I take out my little QRP radio, and I hooked that up and worked many DX with it. In fact, I've taken that QRP radio down here to the park and using a very modest antenna worked DX stations with it. So the last thing you want to do is say, oh, I can't have that big thing in my yard. That's the end of it. I'm not going to pursue amateur radio. I'm not going to pursue CW. I never want to discourage anybody. I'm looking for something else. Oh, hold on.
Send him.
Somebody want to ask a question?
Now, this is KO2OK Bennett. Can you just spend a couple of, maybe 1 minute, 2 minutes on the alternative of using a vertical for the, you don't need a lot of height and it has low takeoff?
Okay, Dick, you want to explain how a vertical can help fill in the gap?
Now, when we talk about horizontally polarized antennas, like a dipole that lays parallel to the ground, for a horizontally polarized antenna, the ground reflection does give you 180 degrees of phase shift on reflection, very close to it at least, and as such, the mirror image and the real antenna are out of phase with each other, and that's the reason why you tend to have a null on the horizon. At some number of degrees above the horizon, the extra path length to the image antenna comes back in phase, and that's the geometry of why you get a peak of elevation at some particular, a peak of signal at some particular elevation angle for a horizontally polarized antenna. The good news about a vertically polarized antenna is the ground behaves differently. For the most part, you do not get a phase shift when a vertically polarized signal reflects off the ground. Therefore, a vertical ground plane-like antenna doesn't necessarily have to be high up. It can be flat on the ground and give you a fairly low angle of radiation. As long as you don't have great big blocking buildings and mountains and whatever in that particular direction that you care about. That's the good news. Let me drop. The bad news is that most of us have... set up our vertically polarized ground plane antenna as a quarter wave resonator, quarter wave radiator, and as such you need a whole lot of ground plane radios in order to get good efficiency. Without a whole lot of ground plane radios, like 10 of them, so to speak, or even more if you're a serious person, you end up quite a bit of the RF energy is going into the soil, heating up the soil, making the worms warmer in the wintertime, but wasting that RF energy as heating the soil as opposed to being radiated into space. You can get around that problem by making the radiator a half wave long instead of a quarter wave long. Now you're feeding it at the bottom of a half wave resonator, the radiator. The impedance goes from 35 ohms to something like 1500 ohms, and now the ground plane radios become much, much less important, and you don't have to worry about putting up a whole lot of ground plane radios. However, to make a, let's say, 80-meter antenna electronically vertically polarized at a half wavelength long, that requires some heroics. It requires more real estate, more altitude, loading coils, and whatever. Doable, but you got to work a little harder for doing it. So the certain advantages of a vertical ground plane-like antenna, and if you can make it half wave or 5/8 wave, you come out way ahead of the game as opposed to quarter wave. And so... there are many a person who will see an advertisement for a vertical quarter-wave ground plane antenna that's advertised that it works on all of these bands, it's got all of these fancy shiny pieces of aluminum and all these tuning coils on the side, and it costs $575, and there's many a guy who falls into the trap of saying, hey, I'm paying a whole lot of money, it must be good. Well, do a little bit more study. Sometimes it's not as good as you think. You may have some opinions on this one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, not at all. Let me tell you, I've seen some, and I have used, I didn't always have the privilege of having a nice sized yard where I could put a tower with a beam and everything. I'm very, very satisfied and feel that, you know, was, I just sort of saw filled my hand dream that was for many years to finally have the antenna installations that I do. But again, I have helped and I've encouraged many people, and they were quite surprised what they were able to do with, as you say, with somewhat of a modest setup. Or, like you say, can't go horizontal, you haven't got the room and everything. You look into some of these verticals that they're selling. They've got some of you got to look carefully. Have a terrific range in the verticals. They seem to be take advantage of the vertical market more than they take advantage of the Aggie market, because if you'll notice, some of them, the claims, which are not usually published anymore in a number of the magazines, but some of the claims are, you know, quite a little bit off the extreme optimism of what the antenna is capable of doing. I don't know what else I can say that's dainty about it. Some of those... shiny top pipe that they sell for a lot of money, and how they really perform over.
Yeah, so before you lay down a whole lot of money and buy one of these fancy antennas that's got great advertising but requires a whole lot of ground plane radials to get good performance, do a little bit more research, is my opinion. And homebrew antennas, that's where we amateurs really shine. We no longer build our transmitters and receivers, with rare exception. We buy those, and a week's salary can buy you something that's going to take you a year to build with your own hands. You come out way ahead to buy the transmitter, buy the transceiver. But when it comes to the antenna, consider building the antenna, because you can get a lot of bang for the money if you use the right techniques. Study the ARRL antenna handbook, antenna manual. Talk to your friends. Get on the TechNet and discuss the subject. I feel like building antenna A instead of antenna B. What do you think? Lots of valuable information for that. Well, with rare exception, unless you've got landlord, unless you have a landlord like Herbie had, you can always find a way of putting an antenna on your property. Okay, I want to go to another one, Mel. K2KEY, KQRIW.
At Zulu Echo. Zulu Echo with a question, when you can. Oliver?
I heard both GLW very weakly, and Zulu Echo, is your question on this particular subject? Go ahead.
No, no, it's actually on about a head. Send me the ham stick I have and how I have it aimed and everything. I wanted to ask you a few questions. When you get around to it, no rush if there's time. Over.
Okay, there's a few ahead of you. Mel, you want to go to another one of your mailbag questions? K2KEY, KQRIW.
I'm looking for something here. Okay. I started into getting interested in radio. Basically, I started listening at the broadcast band. Okay. And I noticed a number of the stations, some of them, when they signed off, they said they start giving, you know, the information of the power they transmit and things like that. And some of them say that they are operating AM/DSB. What is that? And others say, let me see. Oh, others say they are operating something AM. Oh, AM. You know the difference? What is the difference? What are they talking about? Oh, I think you know what he's alluding to, Dick. But you want to give some words on that first?
If you know what he's alluding to, you tell me what you're thinking first, Mel, and I'll add my comments to it. Go ahead.
Okay, the AM band, as we call it, broadcast band, or the middle band, or whatever you want to call it, which extends from 525 to 1705 kilohertz, I believe, in the United States. The original transmission on the original AM stations, still many of them, operate what was known as full carrier double sideband. However, a number of them have gone over to transmitting AM stereo, and that's why they call it AM. It's actually AM angular modulation. I think that's what he's referring to, the one from that go AM/DSB to AM/AM, Dick, over.
If you study what's going on with cell phones these days, you'll find out that there's a zillion different ways of transmitting the voice and data, and new ways are being created all the time. One of them, for instance, is called PRASK, polarization reversal, polarization efficiency, PRASK, polarization amplitude shift keying. It really is another name for double sideband suppressed carrier. Some of them are using subcarriers in order to transmit Muzak and other pieces of information in the case of AM broadcast station. Stereo and other pieces of information are being transmitted on subcarriers. Ultrasonic frequencies like 38 KC, 19 KC, and they put on other kinds of information. And the subcarrier can be FM modulated or AM modulated. So more and more complicated techniques are being devised for squeezing more and more signal, more and more pieces of information onto that radio carrier. That's part of what's going on. Ordinary AM in the old days, let me drop. If you looked at it on a spectrum analyzer and the guy was not talking into the microphone, if it was, for instance, the WINS 1010 station, you would tune your spectrum analyzer to 1.010 megacycles, and there would be this one vertical line in the middle of the screen, represents the carrier. And then the guy picks up the microphone and starts talking into the microphone, and you'll recognize pairs of sidebands above and below the carrier start being created by the amplitude modulation that he creates when he speaks into the microphone. That's what an AM transmitter does. And in the very beginning of ham radio single sideband, some guys would transmit the double sideband suppressed carrier by way of adjusting their circuits accordingly You can stop transmitting the carrier, but transmit only the sidebands. And single sideband is the most efficient one, where you transmit only the sideband of information, suppress the other sideband, but it requires a lot more elaborate circuitry to do it, but you pick up certain advantages of signal strength and range and survival of multipath and selective fading and whatever. So as you get to these more elaborate techniques, you can squeeze in more information. Some of the other more elaborate techniques are quadrature amplitude modulation, QAM as it's called, 16 QAM or QAM. There's sort of 16 different states of digital information can be transmitted on the carrier. So I'm guessing that that's some of what we're running into, that the various techniques for transmitting stereo, muzak, and second audio programming is part of what's going on the more modern AM broadcast stations and some of the FM stations also. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was reading about, oh boy, they have got stuff. I should say unbelievable. So if you hear on an AM station, it's AMDSB. That's basically, as Dick was just explaining, the original way that they broadcast AM. It was AM, double sideband AM, and then they went now to AM, angular modulation. That's because of broadcasting, like Dick says, there was stereo stuff and all. And then there was, of course, double sideband, suppressed carrier. There's a VSG, vestigial sideband. I forgot already how that works in the commercial television business. It was single sideband, suppressed carrier AM. I just can't even remember some of those. ISB AM. I think that is defunct. Am I correct, Dick?
Yeah, don't forget HD radio now, which is digital.
But the independent sideband, that was a real fancy one. I'm trying to think of the name of the company in lower New York State that was transmitting, producing hardware that made independent sideband. In other words, you can picture a single sideband transmitter where you can set it for either upper sideband transmission or lower sideband transmission. Well, think about a combined transmitter which simultaneously transmits upper sideband and lower sideband, but puts two independent pieces of information on them. So one suppressed carrier, upper sideband is program A and lower sideband is program B, independent sideband. And there's significant advantages doing that. It never became very popular, but there's lots and lots of ways. So what's really happening here is that once you create a radio wave, once you create a high enough frequency connected to an antenna, which has the right altitude and it's launching a signal into space, you're really transmitting a radio wave. Now you can decide, am I going to use amplitude modulation or angular modulation? That's the general term for phase and frequency modulation. They call it angular. So as long as I change the transmitted wave in a characteristic way where you, the transmitting guy, and your friend, the receiving guy, both agree on the process by which you're going to modulate that radio carrier. You're going to change its amplitude or its angle of instantaneous phase of transmission, and maybe the combination of the two, and you can do it with all kinds of analog and digital techniques and combined techniques. Once you and your buddy you want to talk to agree on a process, and once you get FCC approval to do that kind of transmission on the publicly owned frequency spectrum, then there's lots and lots of ways of doing it. But they all boil down to either amplitude or angular or combat.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So the only thing that really gets through space is that radio wave at a high enough frequency connected to the right kind of antenna, reflecting off the ionosphere, or a direct wave if it's a VHF, UHF, ground wave, and so on, even maybe a wave transmitted through the Earth. But once you create that carrier, now you have to put information on it. And so some combination of amplitude or angular modulation of the carrier starts conveying the information. Just a pure carrier with no modulation tells the other guy, yeah, you're there, and yeah, the signal's getting through, It's the equivalent of standing in front of a classroom and whistling a 1KC note continuously if you've got enough breaths to do it. You're letting everyone know you're there, but you're not conveying useful information. The degree of unknown characteristics of the information channel that you modulate onto that radio carrier wave is where the real information takes place. Over to you, Mel. I wonder if you have any other questions you think we should get into tonight. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, in my early days when I got involved with Cupboard McDonald and doing his original experiments with flow scans, he tried to petition the FCC to permit IFC. The idea was when you're transmitting a flow scan television picture, that you could also have voice communications at the same time. So it didn't work out that way. But the idea was to consist of using upper and upper sideband and a lower sideband, but both containing different information.
Okay.
Anyhow, I think we covered that pretty much, Dick. So what do you say? One more, or should I stand by?
Try one more. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, staying with our favorite subject, antennas, of course, which is the predominant questions I get. I have a dipole cut for 20 meters, and it's got 45 feet of coax on it, but I'm trying to load it up on 40 meters with the tuna, and the tuna seems to need the full amount of tuna capacitance to get the SWR anything down within reason. Does this mean that I'm consuming a lot of power in the tuna? Oh, I've had this question here so many times. You know, if the more of the dial that you have to turn up on the tuna, does it use more power, Dick? Over.
As I see it, there's at least two things going on here, Mel. If it's a 40-meter dipole antenna, for instance, and if you've made the wire itself a half wavelength long, with an insulator in the center and two insulators at the edge and suspended some reasonable distance above the ground, like more than 15 feet, the dipole itself should be something close to 70 ohms of impedance on a 50-ohm cable, hopefully with a balun device or with a coil of wire near the antenna, the poor man's balun. The antenna should be under or something like a 1.3 standing wave ratio. Therefore, your antenna tuner should not have to work very hard for that antenna. Now, if the guy is using an 80-meter antenna, dipole, and trying to feed it on 40 meters, or if he's made his dipole very, very different than the usual half wavelength, roughly 65 or so feet long, then yes, the antenna tuner has to work real hard, and he's going to be using the full range of the antenna tuner. So my first question is that if he set the antenna to the right length, and the antenna's tuner has to work very hard, it implies that there's a short circuit or an open circuit on the coax cable. It's not connected to the wire of the right length. There's something wrong with the center insulator or with the balun. Something else is wrong if the antenna tuner has to work real hard. And you might want to search that one down. But once the antenna tuner does come into range, the antenna tuner wastes no power at all. If the antenna tuner has to work real hard, you're using its controls to the maximum deflection. Therefore, by way of measuring your standing wave ratio on your transmission line, and you find out you've got a very high standing wave ratio, let me pick a number, 10 to 1. That means the signal bouncing back and forth a whole lot of times on the transmission line. That's what high VAS standing wave ratio means.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because your transmission line is giving you a high standing wave ratio, with that antenna tuner, you can correct it. But that's only giving you halfway to the right performance, if you know what I mean. The fact that the standing wave ratio is high and the antenna tuner is re-reflecting that signal forward so it gets another chance to be reflected by radiated by the antenna, and now your signal is bouncing back and forth on that transmission line a whole lot of times, the transmission line is giving you a whole lot of extra loss. Once you know the standing wave ratio on your transmission line and you know the loss of your transmission line, because you know how many dB per foot it's supposed to be at your frequency, and you know how many feet of it you're using, and you go to the right chart in the antenna book, it'll tell you how much extra loss your transmission line is giving you because of high standing wave ratio. So you're getting extra loss in the system. The antenna tuner is trying to correct it, but he's not causing the problem. The antenna tuner itself, if it's built correctly and used correctly, is a lossless device. Of all the RF power you put into that, all the RF power into that antenna tuner, there's only three things it can do with that power. Reflect some of it back to the transmitter, and by measuring the standing wave ratio between the transmitter and the tuner, you'll know whether or not that's happening. Number two, it's sending the signal up to the antenna and being radiated, and you can make measurements to confirm that that's happening. And the third thing it can do is, if it had a whole lot of leakage to its cabinet, wasn't well shielded, it itself could be doing some of the radiation. I doubt it. Or the fourth thing it could be doing is converting some of the power into heat because it's got lossy components. Well, you run 100 watts key down into your antenna tuner, into your antenna, and you do that for 10 solid minutes, and then turn up the transmitter and open up the cabinet of the antenna tuner and touch everything. If everything inside there is ice cold, there is no way it can be losing you any power. The only way you can lose RF energy is to convert it into heat or to radiate it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Once again, the only way you can lose RF power is to turn it into heat, to reflect it somewhere, or to radiate it into space. And by some very simple testing, you can find out how much. Now, you say these words that I just told you on the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, and a whole lot of people will jump down your throat and give you a whole lot of conflicting opinions. There's a significant number of people out there who are positive the Apollo program was a pure hoax created by NASA and no real landing on the moon ever took place. There's a whole lot of people out there who believe that antenna tuners take all the reflective power from the antenna and chew it up and throw it away. There's a lot of people who believe that. Absolutely not true. And there's lots of testing you can do to prove that. A well-built antenna tuner wastes no power. It doesn't have the ability to do that. K2KEY, K2RIW on the deck net.
Okay, see, the question was, he has a good working, according to him, 20-meter antenna fed with 45 feet of coax. What he's trying to do is put this 20-meter antenna on 40 meters, Dick. That's what he's asking. And this is where he's running out of just about the range of the tuner. And the reason, I guess, you want to say what's happening there, because his antenna, he says, is 35 feet above ground. So the impedance at 7 megahertz, if he says it's working well, so I'm taking for granted that maybe he's got a one-to-one SWR. At 7 megahertz, the R factor in the feed point impedance, the R is going to drop down considerably, while the minus J factor, capacitance factor, is going to go way up, maybe into, I don't know, 800-900 ohms. And that's what's happening, you know, in his tuner over.
Okay. Now that I understand, he's got a 20-meter antenna, which means that it's around 32 feet long, and he's using it on 40 meters where it wants to be 67 feet long. If he wants to know the exact answer, he can go to amateurradio.tangovictor. That's where all of the past recordings of the TechNet exist for the last 5 years. And on that website, you'll also find something called Yagi Technical Information by K2RIW. You click on that little square, and you'll find three charts that are available to you. One is a write-up telling you how to get a perfect impedance match to any dipole-like antenna. And number two, three are two different charts. A monopole reactance chart, which tells me that when you use half the right length, you're going to have something in the vicinity of 700 ohms of capacitive reactance, and your resistive component is going to be at half the normal length. Instead of being a 70-ohm antenna, it's going to be something like a 10-ohm antenna. So the resistive component is 10 ohms, the reactive component is huge, and you take a 20-meter dipole and you feed it on half the frequency. I don't know the exact number, but maybe the antenna is a 30-to-1 standing wave ratio. That's the physics. You're using the antenna on the wrong frequency. It's highly mistuned, so the antenna is giving you a very high standing wave ratio. Therefore, your antenna tuner has to work real hard. That's why you're running out of range on its controls. Let me drop. Your transmission line is running a very high standing wave ratio. It's 45 feet of transmission line of a known number of dB per 100 feet. You therefore know how much loss the transmission line would have under ideal conditions. You go to the right chart in the antenna book by ARRL. You go to the right chart showing you the extra loss that your transmission line gives you when you know how high the standing wave ratio is, and you'll find out that all of the loss you're getting is occurring in your transmission line. As long as the antenna tuner doesn't run out of range, it can give you a good match as far as the transmitter is concerned. And yes, this is going to work, but maybe you're getting, let me pick a number, an extra 3 or 4 dB of loss. That doesn't knock you off the air. It just means that you're a half an S unit weaker than you would be under normal conditions. It's an uncomfortable situation, but it's not a showstopper. And you can operate there if you want to. You can also make the dipole into a fan dipole where you add an extra chunk of wire at the feed point, a chunk of wire that's tuned for 40 meters as well as the chunk of wire you've already got there for 20 meters. So there's lots of corrections here. Not a showstopper, but it's an understandable situation. And you can look up these charts and figure out exactly what's going on if you want to be a scientist. That's your choice. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yep. Yes, I think that we have it on there. If you go, we try to come up with every kind of normal situation that a ham would run into with matching and what it would look like if you charted it, and we did it with the Smith chart back, I think, about a year or so, 2 years ago. So if you go to amateur television, amateurradio.tv, as Dick says, and you look up the Smith chart, I know one of the Smith charts, I did just have to substitute in your figures, and you'll see exactly, you know, what to expect. There's another source that's very good. If you buy the antenna, ARRL antenna book, they give you some very nice discs they have in the back, known as the TL or TLW program. And you can use that, you feed it in there, and you'll see the results you get by, of course, the disc, you know, you stick it to your computer, and you feed in the information, and you'll see, get exactly what's going on there with your particular setup. So this is a question, I could say, comes up quite often, Dick. So that's the best thing to look it back in amateurradio.tv on the Smith chart, over.
I think you guys should give a few more seconds to that fan dipole thing, because a young kid who doesn't have a lot of money, that's a great way for him to get that thing going on 40 meters.
Yeah, good suggestion, Barry. I'm looking at the website right now called www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And the third column on that page is called LIMARC, L-I-M-A-R-C. Under there, from the years 2006 through 2011 inclusive, are all of the past recordings of all of the TechNets. In that third column, you'll find there is a section called The Smith Chart Discussions, and you can click on that, and you can read about the past discussions on the TechNet on the subject of Smith Chart. On that third column, you also see a square you can click on called Yagi Technical Information by K2RIW. That will give you hard copy, so to speak, of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. In other words, every possible dipole and monopole and ground plane antenna of any diameter wire, any diameter radiator, any electrical length that you're ever going to build is on that chart. So once you know the physical layout of your antenna, you can predict ahead of time exactly what impedance it's going to give you if you care to do that. Once you know the impedance of the antenna, you know the standing wave ratio it's going to give you, you go to the Smith chart, you can make this into a science project if you want to. You don't have to. But what Barry is recommending, let me drop. One of the best kept secrets in the world is that I might want an 80-meter dipole, a 40-meter dipole, a 20-meter dipole, a 15-meter dipole, a 10-meter dipole, for instance. A naive person would set up five antennas. You lose nothing by putting all five antennas into one structure. The end of that transmission line, with the right kind of a ballon, or a poor man's ballon, a coil of cable at the end, you set up. Right now, he's got a dipole that is probably around 32 feet long, approximately, for 20 meters. If at the exact same point, he puts on a second dipole, fanned a little bit, a few degrees away from the first one, same point of connection, and this one is now 65 feet long, that's a dipole for 40 meters. And he can add a third dipole, one that's roughly 132 feet long, and he's got a dipole for 80 meters. That exact same antenna will electronically switch between all of those bands. Because that signal comes down that transmission line, it hits all of those dipoles at once. At first, you're going to think they're all going to radiate. Uh-uh. One of those dipoles, if you're on 80 meters, the 80-meter dipole gives you a 72-ohm impedance, and 99% of the power will flow down the 80-meter dipole. The other dipoles are so high in standing wave ratio, they're so high in reactance, they're so high in impedance, that essentially none of the power flows down the other dipoles. So when you're on the 80-meter band, 90-some-odd percent of your power flows down the 80-meter dipole. Flip your transmitter over to the 20-meter band, and 90-some-odd percent of the power goes down the 20-meter dipole and ignores all the others. They are electronically switched out because their impedance is so bad. It's so high. Ain't that cute? It requires very little extra money, very little extra resources, and now you've got an antenna that works on every one of those bands with the full efficiency of your dipole at that altitude, and it electronically switches itself.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You can't go wrong with that. You get a lot of bang for the dollar with a fan dipole. I bet you built a few fan dipoles, and I bet you the guys in the Kings County Radio Club have done those, and I bet almost nobody complains about the way they work. Is that true, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Of course, yes, of course we've used a myriad of antennas, fan dipoles, antennas with wires stick with inductors in. This has all been covered many times, either on a even a number of magazines and plus the TechNet. So I think that nothing is explodes, nothing will burn out, nothing, no smoke or sparks or anything like that, and it's a lot of fun because nothing gives you more pleasure. Easy to buy a rig. No problem, pump the money down, bring it home. But the pleasure you get out of putting up an antenna and talking to somebody a distance away, that's unbelievable. I know I first time thought Dick and myself had to do it a little harder way because we had to also build the hardware equipment down in the shack. Today, I guess that's what Dick says pretty much passe, and I guess for the most part it's that way. But there's still a place where amateurs can do a lot of experimenting and have a great old time and very little money. Wire doesn't cost. Plain wire doesn't cost. And you don't need no fancy wire. Use any kind of wire. Don't let the hair that's got to have special wire. Any wire will work as long as you can support it. All right. You want to go on with the TechNeptic?
Yes, I do. And 14-gauge household wire. You can decide to strip away the rubber insulation if you want to, or you can leave it there if you don't want the wire to tarnish. It's your choice. You get a little bit of extra weight, a little bit of extra wind loading with the rubber left on, but maybe a little bit better ice rejection on an icy day. I don't know. So any old copper, aluminum, or whatever wire can make a dipole. And almost all of your neighbors do not look up in the air, and they do not see wire, with rare exception. So you can put a zillion pieces of wire in your backyard at various altitudes and various angles, fill up the backyard with wire and have antennas on all of these bands, electronically switch between them or open up one coax cable and close up another one as to which you connect to the transmitter and have a grand old time with all of these wire antennas and switch to the antenna that works the best on the band that you're using depending on the band conditions today. It's a real fun thing to do. Okay, of the people who signed in late, we've got Tom, Carl, and Barry in that order. We'll go to them right now. Tom was the next guy who signed in, KB2 Hotel Zulu Echo, and he lives in the Bronx. Go ahead, Tom, if you're there, give us your question, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Tom is not there. Carl was the next guy. I think it was KC2 Foxtrot, Foxtrot Alpha in Trenton, if I got the call letters correctly. Go ahead, I think that's called. You got a call, K2RYW in the TechNet. Well, we're batting 1,000 here. Hope Barry didn't go away. N2 Moon Bounce, what's the latest in your backyard, Barry? And how's that very fancy steerable antenna going, that project? N2 Moon Bounce, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, actually, I've been kind of busy, so I haven't been able to get to it, but the weather's getting warmer now, so we got big plans, really big plans. I have an antenna I'm getting ready to put up with a 75-foot boom on it. It's for 6 meters. It's a monster. That will be going up, I think, within the month. I'm going to be able to work on that. But actually, I really don't have much to add to that. I just wanted to check in, let that be known. And I just want to comment that 6 meters, if any of you guys on this net operate 6 meters, has been opening lately. I managed to work one station in Moldavia, I guess that's how you pronounce it, Moldavia, and another one in England on 6 meters. And this was in the afternoon, about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the afternoon. I heard him one day, I worked him. The next day I heard him, but I couldn't work him. And that was only 2 days ago in 2MB.
Out of curiosity, Barry, what's the call letters of Moldavia?
Oh, God, I got to go back and look. Hang on, maybe I can... Give me a couple of seconds. I got to research that one real quick, and I'll get it for you.
We're having some fun with you there, Barry. Okay.
Question for Mel.
Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Mel, could you describe your antenna breakout that you have for the disconnect for lightning protection? Did you use speedy connectors, or did you use plain PL259s? Give me a little description if you can, if that's all right, Dick.
You got it, Mel.
I'll just say I have sticked with core suspenders and belt system that I have. I've got the antennas all come into the house, and they go to a box, a feed-through, so I have a port through the wall. And they come in, and they go to a box, and on the box is a selector switch that selects any of the antenna systems. I now take, hanging on the wall next to it, is individual cables that I screw on. That's for any of the different consoles. I'm going to say it, I have a lot of radios. My wife is shaking her head here right now. I do have a lot of ham equipment, a lot of ham radios. And so to make sure that only one setup at a time, I can connect that to that box, and then I swing that switch to the appropriate antenna. When not in use, in other words, nothing is hooked to the antenna system, and what I do is I have a ground bar, the whole grounding system that basically I just ground the big one, the top of the tower where the porcupine, the ground porcupine is, John, over.
ER4DX, by the way.
Interesting. ER4DX. Moldavia. How about that? Rare one. All right, any further questions, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
No, that does it. Thank you very much, Mel. And back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I don't have anywhere near as elaborate a setup as that. I've got a dryer port through the wall where all the cables go through. So if I had to disconnect all of my cables from my radios, it's a lot more inconvenient in my particular case. But the tower is well grounded by all of the guy wires and extra ground leads, 6-gauge wire going to ground rods on the north side and the south side of the tower. So although I'm on a high piece of land with a fairly tall steel structure on it, I've only been struck once, and the only damage that I got didn't occur to the ham radio equipment. It occurred to one of the wires of the house itself, the power wiring, and a lot of other equipment in the house, computers, and modems and a television set, they all got damaged. But the head radio equipment, they survived on the one strike I got, which I'm not sure whether or not it was a direct strike or a strike in the neighborhood. I think it was a strike in the neighborhood, and the real lightning bolt came down through the 110-volt wiring. Another person who signed in earlier was Mr. Z.E. That's all he gave me. Mr. Z.E., if you're there, give us your full call letters and your name, and go right ahead with your question. K2RYW in a second. My name is Dick. Okay, Mr. Z.E. couldn't wait. I did hear a weak GLW. I think that's WB2GLW. I'm going to listen on the input and see if I can hear you, Mike. WB2GLW, if you want to make the transmission, go right ahead. K2RYW in the TechNet. Okay, Mike's not there. We're batting 1,000 tonight here, Mel. I think I've gone down the list of everybody who signed in either early or late. And if not, give me your call letters right now. K2RYW in the TechNet.
KC2FFA.
Okay, I think that's Carl. KC2FFA, okay. I might have written down KB2 by mistake. Is that Carl in Trenton? Go right ahead. FFA, you got it. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Right, Dick. No, it's Charlie in Brentwood. Charlie in Brentwood. And just want to come back to my last week's question on a weird antenna setup on the utility pole on my corner.
You've got it, Charlie. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, today I also noticed the same setup on a pole 1/2 mile away from my house, next to a park that had multiple shootings in the last 3 years in Brentwood. And I did some stuff, some checking on Google, and I believe it's called ShotSpotter, and it's interfering with my AM reception, AM medium wave radio. I have a loop antenna on the radio, so I can maneuver it to make it less interfering, but it still interferes. I like to listen to my games and stuff on 660. It seems to be most obvious on 660. But anyway, to make a long story short, there's two in a row. I've checked into it. It's called ShotSpotter, and their antenna is that scan for shots, or even firecrackers will set them off, or even a backfire of a car. It's run by Nexty. Now, Eric last week told me it was probably an antenna. Let me drop for a second. Eric last week suggested it was probably for wireless communication, and I thought that too. It was just a simple wireless connection, no big deal, I don't care. But now that it's interfering with my radio reception, and I see this, I know the FCC is not going to want to listen to my complaint about that. And just wondering if anybody else seen them. But I read it on the internet that they put two of them in Brentwood. They're putting them in Huntington, one in CI, and in the bad neighborhoods where gunshots have been. That park that he put it next to, there's been three gunshots. Like I said, three people have been killed by gunshots. So I looked at the utility box, looked at the information. Let me drop for a second. What I read on the box with binoculars, it says a telephone number, says NextG, RF exposure, and has an NYD 7557 number, which means it's probably an ID number. I googled it, and very hard to find any information, but the best I could find it is called ShotSpotter. They're supposed to be able to triangulate or circulate gunshot sound and send it to the police quicker than somebody can call. Anybody hear about this? Let's see. K2RIW, KC2FFA.
WA2VDH with some information.
WA2VDH with information recognized. I think the way that ShotSpotter works is that a gunshot is obviously usually a very loud popping sound. It's an impulse of audio. Sound travels at roughly 5 seconds per mile, so that if, for instance, you've got an array of these shot spotters stationed around Brentwood, for instance, which one hears the noise first, which one hears it second, and so on, allows you to, it's not triangulation, it's trilateration. In other words,